This is Radio Eco Shop with your host, Alex Smith.
The biggest, the best, the most, the worst. That is the new China, where bicycle bells turned to traffic jams in 20 years. New Manhattans rose up out of the ground. Pollution smeared the sky and the rivers. The world's biggest airport, the world's largest wind farms, the world's biggest everything, as the greatest population on Earth became consumers. As China goes, so goes the world. How Chinese consumers are transforming everything. That's the title from a new book by Carl Gerth. He's a fellow at Merton College, teaching modern Chinese history at Oxford University in Britain. Carl Gerth, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
It's an honor to be on your program.
Carl, I've been watching China for two decades now at least. I'm a little nervous and amazed. Economists tell us North America and Europe can be measured by the health of consumer buying. Give us a couple of snapshots of the new Chinese consumerism.
Well, when I went to China 25 years ago, I found myself transported from being a poor American college student in the U.S. to a rich person in China. The problem was there was nothing there for me to buy. Back then in the 1970s and 80s, there were just a few things that people wanted to obtain. In the 80s, things like video cassette recorders, televisions, washing machines, that sort of thing. In the 90s, their desires expanded. They wanted personal computers, mobile phones, color TVs, and more. And I think now it's gone even beyond just obtaining things to also having experiences, like studying in North America or eating at Kentucky Fried Chicken or attending an Olympics in your hometown.
And what makes this so startling is the tsunami of change from that recent era of China's leader, Chairman Mao Zedong. When it comes to acquiring and wasting stuff in the early 1960s and 70s, what were the sayings and customs that kept consumerism in check?
Well, I think the things that kept consumerism in check, you could probably point to traditional Chinese frugality and all of that, but I think a scarcity of actual things. Back then, it was more than a saying that people should be frugal. It was a fundamentally different view of the economy. Then, I think production was used as the measure of man or person and nation. And I think that was reflected in the popular culture and the newspapers at that time. Back then, when I was a student, in, as late as 1986, we would read the English language newspapers, and we would usually cut out the headlines and post them on our door because they were always something along the lines of fertilizer production up 8.3%. Obviously, the culture then was privileging or praising production as the measure of China becoming a wealthy and powerful country. Now I think they've changed that completely. They've gone from seeing production as the beginning of everything to now cultivating consumption and desire as the foundation for production. China now makes too much stuff, and if you make a lot of stuff but nobody wants it, then it just sits on your shelves and it doesn't do anything for your economy. So I'm interested in the way that China has gone from the 70s of focusing on production to now focusing on consumption.
Is there a particular date when China changed tracks, and why did it happen?
There was a series of changes that began after the death of Mao Zedong in 1976 and the rise of his successor, Deng Xiaoping, which the Chinese call opening to the outside world. This is called in China also the reform era. But I think this also happens simultaneously with a new orientation towards global trade in the United States under Ronald Reagan as well as Margaret Thatcher. So China was in the right place at the right time to take advantage of these new flows of capital, technology, and know-how. They welcomed this stuff in, and it helped jumpstart these changes. By the same token, they felt like their model of the previous three decades, while making them a very egalitarian society, still made them relatively poor and weak internationally.
Would you say this was an inevitable demand from below? I mean, they're going to be seeing television and advertising from the West one way or another, or was it a political directive from the Communist Party? Maybe you could take the case of private car ownership as an example.
Well, I think you can see it as both something that people wanted, but also something that they were pushed into wanting as well. I think the easier part of that answer is that demand from below, the idea that once the state gets out of the way and stops telling you what to do with your life, that you then exhibit a natural desire to drive around in a car. I think there's perhaps some element of that. I mean, Chinese have really taken to cars. They went from 20 some years ago from only having a couple hundred thousand cars to last year surpassing the United States as the number one car market with 13 million units. And I just read today that they're expected to sell 17 million over the course of 2010. So that, as you can see, then they're obviously taking to cars. But for me, the more interesting thing is not that people want stuff. I think we can take that as granted, but how the state plays an important role in pushing people to desire things. After all, roads don't just build themselves, and if you have cars but no roads, maybe fewer people will want cars. Likewise, neighborhoods don't just decide that they want to be demolished and move to the outskirts of town. We've seen so much of that in China, complete neighborhoods demolished, or factories that were once at the center of the city when China was geared towards production, now being moved to the outskirts or moved to suburbs. All of these things create the new possibility, thanks to roads, for cars, but also the new need for cars because people no longer live and work in the same location. I mean, I could keep going for the rest of our interview talking about the policies that the Chinese state has implemented in order to stimulate desire. Take, for instance, state banks. Once upon a time, the idea that a Chinese Communist Party state bank would lend money to people to buy something would be ludicrous. Now the Chinese banks, however, give loans for cars as well as mortgages for houses. So these are all ways in which the state plays a role in getting people to move from being frugal and holding on to their money to spending more money.
I remember in the early 1990s there was still a hope, especially from Greens in the West, that China would see our pollution, the scarcity of oil, the wars we needed, the massive deaths and injuries and car accidents. Maybe they would go directly for sustainable energy, bypassing the mistakes of the fossil fuel age. That was the dream, but it didn't happen. Why not?
Well, first, before I answer your question, I want to say that Chinese themselves saw this as late as the 90s. They saw all of the problems that you outlined. They saw the pollution. They saw that if they went down the car route, they would lose their oil and energy independence, as they have now lost. So they saw all the problems with this, but they went ahead anyway, which makes it all the more puzzling. I think the blame and credit for China's transformation, I say credit as well, because some of this is, of course, very positive. This transformation, then, can be divided into internal and external pressures, things going on with China that made sense for them to embrace cars, as well as external pressure getting them to do the same. China, for instance, has wanted to move its citizens away from agriculture into manufacturing and then up the value chain away from manufacturing, say, stuffed toys for Disney into higher value stuff like computers or cars. So part of its strategy then of moving up the value chain is to get China to manufacture these things that require more know-how, engineers, all those sorts of things that as you transition from an agricultural to an export-oriented economy to an economy with higher value stuff. So that would be one aspect of the internal pressures for China to build these products that are desired all over the globe. The second thing, though, I like to point out, though, is the role of the WTO in all of this. In the early 1990s, China decides that in order to continue having access to export markets for all of its goods, for its stuffed Disney toys and so on, it needed to sign on to WTO so that it could have the same tariff advantages that other countries had as well. Once they sign on to that, before they become full members in 2001, they see themselves as having a very small window in which they can create internationally competitive brands in autos, in computers, in advertising agencies, and everything that you can possibly think of. So the state then sees it needs to seize the moment and create domestic car industries, indeed conglomerates and electronics and everything else that you can think of, very quickly, using its control over its domestic market to first create a foundation for those conglomerates before then later competing against the multinationals after they have much less fettered access to the Chinese markets after 2001. So again, to answer your question, I see it a very complicated picture of internal and external pressures all happening in the context of them realizing that there were significant downsides to all of this.
As you know, Carl, there's a new interest here in the West about the food, where it comes from and what we're eating and the health of it. I want to talk about some changes in Chinese food. Would you tell us about the new demand for meat and the consequences of that?
Well, growing prosperity in China has allowed Chinese to consume not just more cars, but also more meat, a source of protein that was once upon a time considered a luxury item. I certainly remember when I first started going there that we didn't eat much meat. Indeed, you could say that the purpose of the thousands of KFCs and McDonald's and other fast food restaurants popping up is explicitly to get Chinese to eat more pork, chicken, beef, and so on. And of course, it's working. 50 years after a famine killed somewhere between 20 to 30 million Chinese, they now consume something like quadruple the number of calories from animals that they did 25 years ago. As you can imagine, though, this transition from a land of famine to a land of feasts, or at least feasts for a couple hundred million people, has downsides. In addition to the obvious consequences, things like childhood obesity and other health-related lifestyle illnesses, this new diet also produces billions of tons more animal manure. Much of it gets left untreated. Also, there is ever greater numbers of cattle and goats and sheep grazing on ecologically fragile hills in China, consuming all sorts of grasslands, loosening that topsoil, and contributing to those blinding windstorms that you can see by looking up China windstorm. You can see Seoul or Tokyo or places all over the world that are being affected by Chinese dust. China has become, thanks to, in part, this transition to meat-based diets, the number one exporter of dust. So we can see this literal form of blowback all the way on the west coast of North America as it gets into the jet stream. So that's part of the consequences, both for individuals, the lifestyle illnesses that come along with this, as well as ecologically.
Yes, and there's the global warming impact, which we'll get to in just a minute. This is Radio EcoShock, talking with Oxford historian and author Carl Gerth about the new Chinese consumers. Carl, your book is almost a house of mirrors. We are looking at China, but we see reflections of our own excess, like their love affair with disposable products and the avalanche of waste. Is that Chinese or is it American?
That's a tough question. I would say America's a recent invention, so I suspect there are historians out there who could point to anything that we could come up with and say there were progenitors for these things in Eurasia or Latin America or somewhere where there were other ancient civilizations. So I would say it's something that was probably invented elsewhere, seemingly perfected in America, but now extended even further in China.
What are some of the Western brand names most popular in China? What does everybody want there?
I think you'd be hard-pressed to come up with examples of companies, along with their stockholders, who don't want to be in China. Maybe we divide them up the way an economist would between services and products. And services, you see things like restaurants, McDonald's, Kentucky Fried Chicken. Starbucks just announced that it wants to have 1,500 stores set up. Products include things like Boeing jets to Nike shoes to Gap, GM cars, and so on. So, like I said, just about everything that you could come up with here, I imagine those companies have plans to be over there as well.
You have another subtext in the book, As China Goes, So Goes the World, which again reflects back on us, I think, the whole game of brand names, as you mentioned, products that project our personal status. And yet China's is also famous for producing look-alike fakes. How does the world's biggest counterfeiter deal with this confusion?
Well, Alex, I'm an historian by training, and I'm an historian of consumer culture. One of the interesting things about studying consumer culture is that those of us who study it believe that in the 20th century, people increasingly define their identity based on the consumption of branded products that there's a lot of popular media discussion about, and we communicate that meaning to other people through the consumption of these branded products. Say the way that you're driving a Prius or a Hummer or maybe in your case, Alex, riding a bicycle would say something both to you, yourself about who you are as well as communicate meaning to other people. Well, what happens then if you live in a world, as consumers do in China, where increasingly the brands are meaningless or not as stable as they would be in highly regulated markets, where you would trust that the brake parts of your BMW are licensed and certified by BMW to work properly? If they aren't, and that's a true case, that they're actually stuffed with hay or something, and they don't work properly, maybe then all of your ability to define yourself through the consumption of branded products and communicate with that to other people is undermined. That sounds a little bit less serious when we're talking about counterfeit toys or something like that, but it becomes much more serious when you talk about fake medicines, which are also getting into the global supply chain and emanating out of China. So you could say that China has the possibility of greatly extending consumerism to a huge number of people, but you could say that it also has the potential to undermine consumer consciousness by making us have that much less faith in the brands that we consume. I know I sometimes wonder when I go to a pharmacy and buy drugs if the items that are supposed to be in there are actually in there.
You call it consumer anxiety. Does this work? Is it real? Well, even deeper, you suggest China's political elite have purposely steered the population into consumer issues to keep them away from meaningful politics. Of course, that could never happen here. How can you back up that claim in China? What are you talking about there?
Well, as a social cultural historian interested in urban life, I have to admit I'm much less interested in looking at elites as the movers and shakers of society as opposed to riding those people riding on trends. So I'm much less likely to point to something conspiratorial that somewhere up at the top that they're thinking, oh, we want to stay in power. What should we do to stay in power? More bread and circuits for the masses. Instead, perhaps this is even slightly more cynical, I see that voters both in North America and in China, people in China, worry more about their economic well-being and less about any other political consideration. So perhaps Chinese leaders have stumbled onto something by promoting the idea that they're the party of growth rates. I can't tell you the number of people that I've talked to who believe that the Chinese government and having an authoritarian government is responsible for its 10% growth rates over the last 30 years. I've met people in India who have said the same sort of thing. They look at China and say, if only we had a less democratic form of government. So I guess, like I said, I don't think of this as some sort of cabal that's trying to stay in power by giving people bread and circus, but instead by giving people what they want, which or at least the middle class is what they want, higher growth rates. So I think it's something to consider that China, on the one hand, is becoming very unequal, but at the same time, it's successfully moved hundreds of millions of people out of poverty and into these lifestyles, which everything around them, certainly popular culture, is telling them they should be grateful for.
The other thing, too, is I think we have a stereotype that there are grand leaders in a small room in total command of this vast country, whereas your book brings out case after case where local governments seem to have more power and, in fact, some things nobody can control. Would you say that's the case?
Well, you can certainly see that going back to your question about counterfeits. There's an assumption that as China begins to have more intellectual property, more brands to protect, it's going to do more to protect that. That may be true at the national level, but what happens when you have county governments that are completely dependent on the manufacturing of fakes, not only just for people locally who want to have an imitation Gucci bag, but for national and international markets? So there's all sorts of tensions exactly like the ones you're spelling out. That's why I'm the last person to point to sort of puppeteers running a government. I'm much more interested in these sort of social cultural changes that push politicians into doing things rather than seeing them as the people that are making all of the choices for the rest of us.
I agree, and I think it's true all over the world. I have a bad habit of reading American financial blogs, and there is a whole pack of pundits saying China will collapse soon due to a real estate bubble many times larger than the fallen American market and a banking bubble too. And we've seen Google Space photos of tracts of empty houses or even empty new cities in China. You say in your book the wealthiest developers are connected directly to the current rulers. Is there big trouble brewing in the Chinese real estate market, and what could that mean for the Communist Party?
Yes, I think everybody has agreed that there is a big housing bubble in China, but they've agreed on that both not just on financial blogs, but also within China at the same time. Everybody knows there's one, and the government is implementing specific policies to try to quell exactly the sort of speculation, making it harder, for instance, to buy more properties than you're actually going to occupy, or not allow you to buy them until they're actually built, all sorts of policies like that. But as with cars, and similar to here, it's already become an incredibly important part of the economy, so you don't want it to grow too quickly. On the other hand, you can't afford for it to stop. I certainly think, as your question suggests, that the burst will lead to all sorts of social tensions that are already present in Chinese society. And yes, part of that will mean that the hated rich, the people who got wealthy because of their family connections, might be even more hated. More hated to lead to a rebellion or something more serious? That's anyone's guess.
You have a whole chapter on extreme markets. Part of that is the sex trade. Can you briefly explain, and I know these are huge questions I'm asking you in a tiny time, but how population policy may be a factor in the sex trade in China?
I suppose I could boil it down to a simple formula. Traditional preference for males plus one-child policy equals society with tens of millions of more bachelors than there are women for them to marry. I can see that in China, that what starts out as something done very locally without state approval grows into something done by larger and larger, better capitalized, better organized groups of people until finally the state takes it over. You can see that in cases of prostitution rings in China, going from something heavily suppressed to something gradually overlooked that perhaps the police are complicit in, to eventually the police themselves or the state themselves licensing this, not only as a way of making money in down times, but also a way of giving men an outlet.
The other extreme market so hated by Western greens is the Chinese reversion to traditional medicine that demands exotic animal parts like bear claws, the tiger penis. Well, shark fins for soups isn't a medicine necessarily, but it's a terrible habit. Is China so large, do you think, that these could bring about species extinction?
I think it already is. Yeah, it's a question of scale and speed, isn't it? As with much of the impacts of Chinese consumerism, as more people can afford these once rare things, they start to buy these things, and the impact of that many more tens of millions of Chinese eating tiger penis and shark fin soup and so on means that that's creating havoc all over the world. You could add on top of that the ease which global trade makes it for Chinese consumers to obtain shark fins from as far away as the Chilean coast. There are, of course, efforts in China to reverse some of this. There are PR campaigns with famous Chinese actors and public figures trying to tell people that they shouldn't end their wedding with the traditional shark fin soup, that rather than being a sign of class, it's a sign of ignorance. But I think that those sort of things have a long way to go, and whether they occur quickly enough and change people's minds quickly enough to save all of those species is anyone's guess. It doesn't look very promising, though.
But you do raise an important point that we're not trying to demonize this wonderful country, that there are so many positive things going on, and everything that you and I are debating are definitely talked about in China, and there are efforts on almost everything to try and correct the course where there are problems. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is Carl Gerth with a new book, As China Goes, So Goes the World. As we've seen, hundreds of millions of Chinese people have bought into the Western ideal of consumerism. They love televisions, mobile phones, refrigerators, air conditioners, and all the electronic goodies. Almost 70% of that runs on coal-fired electricity, burned inefficiently with low-grade equipment. Carl, the right-wing voice of U.S. business, the Heritage Institute, who I love to quote, claims Chinese dependence on coal is, quote, an insuperable obstacle to an international climate agreement. Their graph shows Chinese coal burning quadrupled from around 200 million tons in 1999 to 826 million tons in 2009, and now the government has stopped publishing those coal statistics. How serious is this problem of coal burning in China?
Alex, I'm a regular listener to your program, so I could point to any number of insuperable obstacles to international climate agreements. The question for the Heritage Foundation is, why are you picking this one? And you might add on top of that, what sort of complicity does the U.S. have in Chinese burning coal, and what sort of complicity will we have in the coming decades? I don't think I need to remind your listeners that the U.S. is the Saudi Arabia of coal. Well, what happens as we increasingly become even more indebted to China, as Chinese need more and more coal? It's pretty easy to imagine that Wyoming and Western state congressional delegations push to sell more and more coal and keep coal out of climate negotiations. So I think the problem is, as you said, the problem is that Chinese are burning way too much coal, but I think it's not just their problem, as you said at the end of your earlier question. It's a problem for all of us.
And they're producing things in those factories to sell back to us, so some of that is our coal burning.
Exactly.
A couple of weeks ago in December, news agencies reported some Chinese cities were running low on coal or even rolling blackouts. And I know nothing is simple in China. These articles mentioned that coal producers say the government fixed prices too low, and some local governments are actually trying to achieve energy efficiency targets set by the central government in Beijing. And, of course, it's a colder winter than expected. But they could be perilously close to peak coal, and I know they're trying to get it from Australia and from Canada and anywhere they can find it.
Yeah, I can't speak to whether or not they're close to peak oil or not, but we can all certainly see that they're looking around very anxiously to find new resources, and that quest to find new resources is only going to continue. Fortunately, as you suggested earlier, it occasionally has some upsides, like them embracing green technologies and rushing towards that as well.
I was surprised to learn from your book that one quarter of China is already a desert and that area is growing rapidly, partly due to consumer demands, but there are also deeper water problems involved in Chinese agriculture. Can you talk to us about that?
Yeah, well, I have to admit that final chapter of my book on the environment, where I pulled together all of the things going on in the Chinese environment, was pretty eye-opening for me as well. I think, like many specialists on China, I was aware of the various problems, but it never put them together in one chapter. And when you do put them together, they're very serious. I think desertification or sandification, as you've said, is a serious problem. You can look on those satellite images and see that Beijing may be uninhabitable in the coming decade or two at the most, especially if this massive south-north water project doesn't work. And yes, water is a significant issue already on the North China Plain, the breadbasket of China. Most of Chinese land on that plain is irrigated, meaning they pump the water out of the ground. Those tables are dropping very quickly. China is becoming a very arid place, and I think solving those problems, I find it hard to believe that as much faith as Chinese have in engineers, that they can engineer their way out of all of these problems simultaneously.
Well, we've certainly covered some doom and gloom. Can you give us a couple of fun shots, the way Chinese people express themselves in what they buy and these consumer trends?
I think we can look in the mirror or look in the shopping or think about the ways in which we ourselves, including me, after writing a book that includes a lot of doom and gloom, I enjoy consumerism as much as the next person. I like to have a choice in the vegetarian restaurants that I go to in China. When I first started going to China 25 years ago, in the wintertime, all we had was bai cai, Chinese cabbage, day after day of bai cai, with occasionally some other thing thrown in. But now you can eat some of the best food in China. You can go to some of the most beautiful buildings in China. You can find some of the most beautiful or well-stocked shopping malls, some of the nicest dresses, some of the best art. There are endless numbers of consumerism that we all celebrate and enjoy, and that the Chinese also celebrate and enjoy, as well they should. I've seen them make 20-plus years of sacrifices in order to have one fraction of the quality of life that we do. So I think all of these things are wonderful. As I said, I'm not trying to cast aspersions. I'm only trying to suggest that their problem is our problem.
And I guess as a historian, you know, I struggle to look into the history of China, and it's very difficult for somebody outside to even comprehend the basics of it. And the records are not what we expect in Western records of European style history. So are you seeing those long, deep trends that went on for centuries in Chinese history? Are they still bubbling to the surface in this new industrialization?
It depends what sort of trends you're talking about. Certainly, one of the things that we're all curious about is whether or not the individualism that's such a fundamental part of consumerism, that you get to create your own identity from the infinite number of possibilities out there provided by all of that consumer stuff, whether or not that the Chinese will have as much appreciation or tolerance, depending on your point of view, of that level of individualism, or whether they'll be much more comfortable at the level of the state checking that. We certainly saw that in 2008. I remember that green organizations after 2008 openly began to wonder whether or not the authoritarian traditions of China, which we spent 20 years castigating, might not be part of an answer for scaling back consumption. In 2008, I'm pointing to that because we all remember that Beijing made enormous efforts to reduce the air pollution, and one of the ways they did that was to decide that on odd or even days, you weren't allowed to drive your car. So if your car ended, your license plate ended in a 5, you weren't able to drive on Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and vice versa if you ended in an even number. So I think there are traditions of governance and collective, looking out for collective good that continue down to the present that have been suppressed for a while that there's signs that are starting to reemerge.
And certainly the academic training is only going to serve them well. As we wrap up, what have we missed, Carl? Is there something you would like to add?
I remember 25 years ago when I first started learning Chinese, I had a sort of odd experience. I'd look up words in Chinese and I'd find that I didn't know their English equivalents. The reason I mention this is that I found that learning Chinese also gave me a deeper appreciation for English. I would suggest that the same is true with grappling with issues of consumerism, of environmentalism, of extreme markets, and all the other topics that we talked about, that by looking at these issues in the context of China or India or some other country than your own, will give you a new perspective on these same issues.
We've been delving into the new consumer culture sweeping China. The book is, As China Goes, So Goes the World, How Chinese Consumers Are Transforming Everything, by Oxford historian Carl Gerth. The book is short and full of facts and ideas that kind of punch me in the face on every page. I like it. Carl, I was astonished at some of those raw numbers you brought out, just how anything could be that big, how everything could be that big. I've got links to Carl and the website for his book in the Radio EcoShock show blog for this program at ecoshock.info, or download this interview as a free MP3 from our website, ecoshock.org. Carl Gerth, thank you for talking with us.
Thanks for having me on.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.